Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is the newest episode of the new year. We're back from hiatus and so excited for what's to come in 2019. Today is January 7th, 2019, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. Now, you've heard me say it before if you've been listening to the show up to this point. If not, then I'm going to say it for the first time. Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And that's because of the support from incredible individuals just like yourself. The best way to support the show is to visit www.patreon.com/talknerdy. You can pledge your support on an episodic basis. So I want to give a big shout out to our top supporters of the show right now. And they include Rob Schreck, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Each of these individuals is pledging at least $25 per episode to support the show. But of course, your pledges in any amount are incredibly helpful. I've got individuals who pledge everywhere from 50 cents all the way up to, well, the sky's the limit. So if you're interested in doing so, again, go to patreon.com/talknerdy. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart. Of course, there's other ways to support the show, like rating and reviewing on iTunes or other podcast apps. And you can visit my Talk Nerdy web store. It's talknerdymerch.com. And there you can find all sorts of cool stuff from embroidered beanies and hats to hoodies and t-shirts to mugs and even signed copies of all of the books that I've been involved in recently. So check it out. There's a lot of cool stuff, including a brand new design that features Killer the Science Dog. Oh, it's so cute. All right, guys, without any further ado, I'm excited to jump into this week's episode. It features author J.R. Becker. Now, J.R. Becker has written some really cool books, and these books are for kids. I'd say they're for adults as well. They're beautifully illustrated books that really celebrate, you know, scientific concepts, but in a palatable way, in an educational way, but also an exciting and whimsical way. And I hate to have to say this, but I think I should, in a non-threatening way. So far, JR has written four books, and we'll be going through each of those over the course of the show. But he currently has a Kickstarter for the fifth book, Sapiens, A Human Evolution Story. So if you're interested in supporting that, just look up Sapiens, A Human Evolution Story. It's book five of the Annabelle and Aiden series. And I think his name is listed there as Joseph Becker, because the J's got to stand for something. All right, guys. So without any further ado, here he is, J.R. Becker. Well, J.R., thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Kara. It's great to be here.
So I apologize that we've been back and forth with scheduling for quite some time. I'm so glad that we were able to kind of align our calendars to talk about the really cool work that you are actually doing in the space of children's literature. So I guess the first thing I would want to ask is, how did you get into writing kids' books?
Ooh, that's a good question. Well, I guess I could say that about 8 or 9 years ago, I'm a writer. I love writing. That's just what I love to do, and especially creative writing. And I had a novel in my head for years, and I wrote it and self-published it about 8 or 9 years ago. It took me 4 years to write, and I'm like, I am never, ever doing this again. writing quote unquote adult books is just, you know, I think it's also because I had to pare it down, and it ended up being 800 pages. It was just a crazy project that I went down a deep rabbit hole for. But I wanted to keep writing. So I'm like, I could write children's books. They take a tenth of the time to write. And it's a different kind of skill, because you're trying to say a lot in very few words and really just break down deep concepts into words that children could understand. And I'm an artist too, so even though I don't do my illustrations in my children's books, I direct the illustrator, and it's just a more creative kind of task in those sort of ways. And that's sort of how I got into children's books in general. Yeah.
You know, your approach, though, to writing these kids' books is really, I would say, different than most of the books that you see on the shelf when you visit the children's section of a bookstore. And that's because you really maintain the angle or the vision of a scientific skeptic, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, you know, I gave you the kind of boring and technical reason why I write children's books, but the reason why I'm really getting the amazing, amazing story of evolution and the Big Bang and, you know, the story of our species and all these amazing stories in science is because I think Bill Nye once said, when you're in love, you want to tell the world. And I feel like a lot of people are telling adults. And there, I saw a huge gap in children's literature for this kind of stuff. I mean, as we speak, there might be 5 or 6 books on evolution on Amazon right now, tops. There might be 3 on skepticism. I mean, there's just not a lot at all. So I wanted to fill that gap. And, you know, not to get too deep into it, but I grew up in a religious home and I was kind of taught that the world works in a much different way. And as I got older, I started to question a lot, pretty much everything that I was taught. And, you know, we could get into that more if you want later. But I shed pretty most of my beliefs. And I'm like, well, if that's not how it works with a magic wand and, you know, sort of a man in the clouds behind everything, how does it work? Why do I have 5 fingers on each hand and not 4 or 6? And why do I have 2 eyes and not 3? And why, now I'm thinking about butts because I was just listening to your older episode with Anna, you know, why do we, you know, all these questions, how does it all work? And I was left with that emptiness. And then I spent many years reading every book I could find on things that I was interested at that time. And I was just like a kid in a candy store. I was like, wow, this is amazing stuff. Why is nobody talking about this? You know, we give children myths and fairy tales, which are important to expand their imagination, from Jack and the Beanstalk to Peter Pan, a lot of Bible stories. They could be important. They could have their place. But I'm like, you know, reality is just as exciting as fiction. And it just so happens to be true. And we could use it to change the world. So why don't we do that also? I mean, why aren't we teaching kids about this stuff also? Every single kid, every single 5-year-old in the world knows Jack and the Beanstalk. But I bet 10% of them know evolution, or that we're literally all related and made of the same stardust. And that's mm-hmm. literally true. So that's why I do what I do.
Do you, as a father, utilize some of the conversations that you have with your own children? Like, what is the interplay between how you write what you write and, you know, the real world experiences that you've had?
Right. So for interesting reasons, I'm kind of surrounded by a religious geographic and a religious community. And it's a funny dance that I do. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I'm so busy that I wish I saw my kids more. I mean, I'm working on these books and I'm working as an attorney. And, you know, I this stuff doesn't even come up that much, but it does with my friends and family sometimes. With kids, I think it's so important. I think the most important thing for me is maintaining some sort of objectivity with my children, that they should know that there are other people in the world that believe this, and there are some people in the world that believe that, and there's lots of different kinds of people that believe lots of different kinds of things. And when they're older or younger or never, whatever they want, they could believe or not believe whatever they want. But I feel like that's important to me. So whenever my kids are learning A, I'll tell them, well, you know, a lot of people think B. Or when they're learning B, I'll tell them, well, you know, a lot of people think A, just to kind of maintain some kind of objectivity. So they're not, I guess, indoctrinated in that way. You know, I think it's important for people to know. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a tough dance for a lot of, and I'm saying this deeply from a place of assumption because I don't personally have children. I do work with kids in a psychology capacity because I'm training to be a psychotherapist. So in my practicum, you know, I see kids on a regular basis. But it's a tough dance, right? Because there's a certain amount of trust. There's a certain amount of necessity in kids kind of thinking that their parents or that the parental figures in their lives have, at least in the earliest stages of development, a bit of an infallibility that they kind of are the keepers of the answers and they are the holders of what is truth. But then, of course, a very specific developmental stage happens in which we realize that our parents are just people and that there are a lot of other perspectives in the world and that the way that we do things in our own home is not necessarily the way that other people do them. And I guess I'm wondering about that difficulty and that dance when your kids are really little of being like, this is how things are, or kind of trying to imbue a skepticism of, well, I know that's what I said, but other right. people say other things.
Right. It's funny you say that because I'll be like, clean your room, do this, do that, listen to whatever I say. And then on another day, I'll be like, question everything, question whatever anyone tells you, even what I tell you, question my authority, question everyone except me, basically. You know, a funny quandary. I know.
It can be a little confusing for little ones, can't it?
Yes, yes. It's a day. I'm still learning every day, so. Yeah,
absolutely. As I think most everyone is. So, you know, we mentioned fatherhood. We mentioned your kiddos. And are your kiddos actually named Annabelle and Aiden? Is that what your book series is named for?
That's exactly right. I wanted to name it Sophie and McDonald because I just thought it sounded cute. And I wanted to kind of keep my kids out of it. And my friends told me, number one, Sophie and McDonald sounds horrible. Number two, name it after your kids. And it kind of grew on me. I love their names so much. And I'm like, okay, cool. You know, I'll do that. And it all worked out.
Can I just say that flipping through the pages, and I'm starting here, I figured, you know, there's so far there are four published books in the series, so I think we have the time to be able to discuss all of them. So sure. I'm starting with what I think is the first one, Annabelle and Aiden in the Story of Life. Yeah. And can I just say, first and foremost, I know I'm talking to you, the author, and the writing is wonderful, but Max Rimbaldi, what a talented artist. I mean, the images in this are just stunning.
Thank you. Yes, everyone who sees the series says, you know, they don't know if I'm the author or not or who I am. They're like, the art is incredible. It's amazing. I'm like, thank you. Thank you. I really know how to pick them. I really know how to hire them.
And so is that a friend of yours? Is it an artist that you had worked with in the past? What's the story there?
So this is actually very interesting. I thought it was a guy because Max, but it's a woman. I've done four books with her. Her real name, I think Max is her nickname. I think her name is Valeria or something like that. Mm-hmm. I have never spoken with her and I have never met her. She lives in a village outside of Venice, Italy. And I found her on the internet and I've done four books with her and it's all over email. English is her second language or third language. She has sort of a limited English. And it's all been over email and it's incredible. And if I ever meet her, I will give her a big hug. It's amazing that we've never met or spoken. And it's been 3 years and four books so far. So, yeah.
Wow, that is incredible. I mean, it's just such a testament to the power of technology and its ability to really bring people from all over the globe together, even if, you know, the language, like you said, is limited. There are translation services that you were able to fully describe and explain what you want this book to be. And she's able to deliver this stunning imagery that perfectly corresponds with your writing. That's so crazy that you guys have never met. It's really cool.
Yeah, thanks. I am very picky about the art, and I spent I probably spent 3 months, you know, an hour or two a day for 3 months, kind of really just looking all over the internet. I found someone in Poland who does what's called photo manipulation, where you might, I don't know if you or many of your listeners might have heard of it, but he takes different photos and kind of blends them in, and it looks extremely surreal and incredible. And I really wanted him, but he was not available. And then I found Max, and I actually, in this first book, like that elephant on the cover is mm-hmm. a photograph of a real elephant taken by the Polish photographer. And I incorporated, you know, with Max's help, we incorporated into the book. So it's actually, Max did probably 80% of the art, but I did incorporate some elements from these Polish photographers. Very interesting in that way.
That's super cool. And so when we look at this very first story, Annabelle and Aiden in the story of life, how deep does the story of life really go in this, what would you say, 17, 18 page book?
Right.
Oh, so, 21 page book. I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. So, you know, it's funny. People told me I can't write a book on evolution because it's not a story. It's just a bunch of facts. And I said, you want to bet? Of course it's a story. Once upon a time, there was the first living thing. I don't really talk about how life began, abiogenesis, because I wanted this book to be about evolution. And then I take a little poetic license, that first living thing, you know, it needed some friends to share its world with, quote unquote. So it made some copies of itself. And then I explain in a page or two how, genetic mutation and natural selection occur. And then those life forms turn into different life forms depending on their environments, et cetera, et cetera. And then I go through all, you know, a lot of different fun animals and species and humans. And then I think Aiden, who's the skeptic in my book, asks, you know, how do we know this is true? How do we know all this? And then, you know, I had a lot of fun going into embryology of human beings on one page, why we have that little notch under our nose, that little groove under our nose, because we still grow like a fish with fish eyes on the sides of our head. And then shortly before we're born, our head is kind of squished together like a human. So we still have characteristics of fish in the embryo, such as gills, which later turn into our jawbone and our ear canal. And, like a year later, a father sent me a message saying his daughter can't, because of my book, his daughter goes around school pointing at the groove under her nose and telling all her friends why she has it.
I love that.
That was really fun. And how we have tailbones and whales still have leg bones. And I try to give the kids activities to do, like they could touch their tailbone with their hand and things like that. And then, you know, it happened naturally. I didn't plan this, but all of these scientific lessons, and we'll see in all of my books, I end with an ethical lesson. I mean, there's so much we could learn from this. We're literally all related in the same family tree. And then I end with this could teach us that we need to treat each other well. We're all related. We have the same stuff, and we're made of the same stuff. And that's it. That's how deep the story goes.
And I love that it sort of exists on two typography planes, in that there's the main text, which is rhyming text, you know, in short stanza form on each page that stands out against everything else. But in many of the pages kind of integrated into the artwork, there's, you know, a little bit of slightly more, shall we say, sophisticated text that's sort of written almost handwritten as part of the stylistic imagery. And that gives you just a little bit more depth. And maybe it also helps kids grow into the book a bit as well.
Exactly. So we wanted the books to grow with the kids. And we wanted to kind of disguise these scientific footnotes, I call them, and integrate them into the illustration so they don't disrupt the art of the book. But rather look natural. And a lot of people loved it. And then a small minority of people, you know, say it's hard to read, it's too small. So we're trying to make those footnotes a little bigger. But, you know, the majority of people say they like that it, you know, they, you know, it's funny how the very point of making them not disturb the art is making them a little hard to read so that as the kid grows, they could notice things that they didn't notice before. But that same thing does frustrate some people because they're hard to read. So that's something we're still trying to find a balance on. But yeah, there were just some cool facts that I'm like, you know, kids got to read this stuff and it won't fit in the stanzas. So I need to sneak them in somewhere. I'm just excited about a lot of these, you know, these lessons. So.
Absolutely. And speaking of lessons, moving on to your second book, which is called Annabelle and Aiden Presents, Oh, the Things We Believed. So this really is a, you know, the first book was science, it was evolution, but this really is kind of a to-the-point skepticism book for kiddos, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And so what is kind of the arc there?
I'm trying to, you know, when I knew I wanted to start a series, but when I wrote the first book and published it, I did not know. I don't think I knew what I wanted the second book to be about. I'm trying to remember how I thought of the idea. I think over a period of 3 or 4 months, I just kind of jot down ideas. I always have 7 or 8 ideas written down somewhere. I still do. But this book, I thought, how much fun would it be to kind of, how whimsical is it? I mean, storks delivering babies and a flat earth on the back of turtles all the way down. I mean, a lot of these myths and fables that we used to believe, or some people still believe, is basically made for children's books. And nobody's done that. And then I thought, what better way to do that? What better way to show the beauty of the scientific method and how, you know, fantasy is amazing, but facts are just as amazing and actually true, and we could change the world with them. So I thought of doing this book and kind of poking fun at flat earthers and storks delivering babies and demons and witches and all of that, and just have fun with it.
Yeah, and it seems like the idea here is that kind of from an adult perspective, it's a bit poking fun at things that we know are, you know, highly politically charged, things that we as, you know, adult skeptics really believe must be subject to ridicule if we're going to maintain any semblance of, you know, sanity in society as a whole. But at the same time, with kids, you know, the excitement of the imagination of, you know, really starting to differentiate reality from fantasy is quite wiggly. And so the idea here isn't to say all that stuff is wrong and stupid. You should only know about things that are real, but it's to say, like, these things are fantastic. And these other things that are real are also fantastic.
Exactly. It's exactly right. Yeah, the fantasies and the myths are wonderful, but you know, I'm kind of like, you know, but look what's behind my back. You know, I'm kind of wheeling in another cart from the back of the room, like, oh, by the way, we grow food this way, and we learn how space and time bend, and we climb to the stars, and we care for our Earth, and we do all these amazing things with science. So, and then I try to kind of teach kids they're both fine. But learning what's real, you know, your feelings trick you. And, you know, probably, you know, I would love to hear what you thought as well. But I think the most, you know, one of the most important pages is kind of explains how we evolve to see patterns that don't exist and why we hear voices in our head or see fault. We're pattern seeking creatures. And I thought that was an interesting point I wanted to make with the book.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's one of those central things that every skeptic, even grown-ups, need in their toolkit. A lot of adults don't understand things like, you know, pareidolia. And so it is interesting, definitely, to start little kids understanding that stuff from a young age so that it's just second nature. It's just another thing they know. You know, I'm reminded, you know, based on this conversation that we're having right now, of an experience that I had recently, a kind of academic experience, a run-in with a psychology professor, not one of my own professors, but a professor at my university. We were talking about, kind of in an informal chat with a lot of people, about little kids and the things that they say and how we listen and frame and reflect and direct and psychoeducate, but also try and, you know, maintain a sense of awe and wonder with children within the kind of play therapy setting. And she mentioned, and the reason I bring this up is because when we were talking about the idea that these fantastic things are fantastic, but there are other things that are actually real that are fantastic too, is that I think a misperception of skepticism that I often run across is people being like, oh, you just want to ruin everything. And so I'm sitting here talking to this woman and she says, you know, it's so interesting when little kids talk about their past lives. And I was like, oh God, what are we getting into now? And we start to have this conversation and I'm like maintaining pretty firm, like, oh yeah, I mean, the psychological explanations for this are quite fascinating and it's a cool thing to explore. You know, what memories are they tapping into? What experiences that may have been a little bit, you know, unconscious or subconscious are becoming, you know, part of the consciousness and blah, blah, blah. And she was just, I could tell, like offended or almost annoyed that I kept offering rational responses instead of just saying, oh yeah, or maybe they had a past life. And it was such an interesting exchange because I could see her frustration and I could see her, you know, and even she would say things like, oh, you know, I just feel like you're really close-minded or you're really just looking for any excuse. And it was frustrating for me because I felt like what she was saying to me was, oh, you're no fun. You don't want these kids to be experiencing this fabulous thing. And it's like, no, I don't want you to reinforce to them that they have magic.
And you care, you know, we care about children's minds and the world. And, you know, that's why I think a lot of people debate whether or not, you know, astrology is real or faith healers or God or angels, whatever it is. But I think it's not, it's often not a debate over whether or not that thing is real. It's a debate over whether or not faith is a virtue. And that's why I think people should stop, you know, before even arguing about that, because, you know, people are tribal and they have their positions and they're just going to keep arguing back and forth. I think it's important to talk about, is it good for our minds and is it good for the world to believe beyond the evidence? You know, we are open beyond the evidence. We have to be as, you know, as scientists, but to actually believe beyond the evidence. I just keep thinking through our talk about Carl Sagan, and he, you know, when I wrote this second book, Oh, the Things We Believed, I had not yet read Carl Sagan or The Demon Haunted World. And a year later when I read it, or maybe 6 months later, I was like, wow, this is kind of like the soundtrack of my second book. I didn't even know it. And I love how Carl Sagan starts The Demon Haunted World. He is on a plane ride. He relates the story and someone's sitting next to him. And when they find out he's a scientist, they ask him whether or not the underwater city Atlantis is real. And Carl Sagan says, you know, probably not. We don't have any evidence of it. And the guy looks so disappointed. And Carl Sagan writes in the book, you know, did this guy know about the molecular building blocks of life sitting out there in the cold, tenuous gas between the stars? Had he heard of the footprints of our ancestors found in 4 million year old volcanic ash? And so, you know, he names all these amazing things in science. It's like we could have that awe and amazement. We don't need to, you know, damage our minds and engage in fleeting fantasies to be amazed. So that's, you know, that's something that came to my mind.
Absolutely. And so I think now is a good time to kind of switch gears and talk a little bit about the third book that you wrote. And I have to admit, I'm really excited to talk about the final, I shouldn't say final, but the most recent book that's been published. So we'll get there, I promise. Hold your horses, guys. But before that, let's talk about Worlds Within Us. What does that refer to?
Worlds Within Us is, you know, this will sound very cosmosy, but a lot of scientists and science communicators say the number one most inspiring thing about science is that we are literally made of the gas and the dust that was created by, that was, you know, stardust, star stuff. It's a cute saying, and people think it's just kind of an allegory or an exaggeration, but it's not an exaggeration. So Worlds Within Us is kind of saying that we have worlds within us. We have the world. We are the world. You know, we are the world gazing at itself. We are made of our world. We are made of the stardust that was formed after the Big Bang. It formed planets like the Earth, the book explains, and from the Earth came us. So we are made of stardust. We're all made, and I kind of use that as a vehicle, as I do in all my books, to try to bring some sort of unity and love between people and the planet and animals, that we're all made of the same stuff, which is literally true.
And of course, that brings along with it, as you mentioned earlier, a real kind of ethical call to action as well, because in understanding, or at least offering a deeper understanding of the interconnectedness of humans, of all organisms on the planet, and of the actual physical stuff, you know, even the non-living stuff of the Earth itself, you can't help but feel a sense of kind of, I don't know, responsibility, obligation, pride, virtue in that connection.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the ills in today's society and the society of yesterday is the belief that we're somehow separate from nature. We're almost ashamed of being part of it. People, you know, one person might quip, you know, don't call me an animal. They're eating like animals. We don't like to be called animals. I mean, Planet of the Apes kind of makes fun of this. And when we start to drop that belief and understand that we're all related and we're part of nature, you know, it changes the way you look at, say, factory farming or environmentalism. So, you know, that's one thing. Another point I just want to say quickly, I try to use this book to also empower kids. You know, worlds within us, that we have a piece of the world inside us. And at the you know, a lot of children I hear, you know, bullying is a big problem, and children feel very small, like they can't make a difference. So, you know, in my book, Aiden says, you know, I'll learn about the stars, but they make me feel so small. The world is so big. How could we know if we matter at all? So then tardigrade Tom comes in and says, before it grew, the whole world was smaller than you. I thought that was a good way to kind of start the Big Bang, and it's true.
Absolutely. And so who is tardigrade Tom?
I had to get a tardigrade in there somehow.
I know, I had, right?
So it took me, you know, until the third book. I think it took me till the third book, but I did it.
And I see that even your author image that you often use has a little tardigrade on your shoulder.
Exactly. I had to.
How can you not love a good moss piglet? I mean, they're just the
best. They're adorable. I don't think I even knew about them. I'm so embarrassed to say, when I started this book series. And then I learned about them, and I realized, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think there is any cartoon or movie or kids book in the world with a tardigrade character that I know of anyway.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, anything happens, anything could happen in Japan. There may be like a whole franchise, yes, around a tardigrade. But you're right. I don't know of any very like mainstream, you know, and I hate to be so Americo-centric, but that's, of course, where we're recording this podcast and where this book is published. Any mainstream tardigrade characters in sort of the popular consciousness, which is amazing because they're the best. They're super cute. They're fantastic. They have all the qualities, like they have these very mammalian qualities, except that they're, you know, microscopic and, you know, exist in pond scum. Yet, of course, we've heard all the amazing stories about their insane abilities to be desiccated and come back to life, to go to space and come back to life. And I mean, just what incredible creatures.
Absolutely. I'm like little pink water bears that float around and swim around and pretty much can't die. And you could burn them or put them in space or boil them. I mean, yeah, it came in naturally. So,
all right. And so, of course, I was mentioning before that I was so excited to talk about your most recent book. This is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. It's a topic that some authors have attempted. There are other books, both for adults and for children, about facing death, about grief, about loss, about our own mortality. But I think a big difference here is the conversation that is really in the title, which is what happens when we die. So tell me a little bit about how you went about broaching this very difficult topic and kind of what you gained from it as you went along.
Sure. You know, I think this idea came from, I go to the Secular Homeschoolers Conference every now and then. They've been a great support to me, and they really love my books. And they really, really, a lot of parents came to me and really requested that I write a book about death for children. And I thought it would be a good idea, but it's kind of a daunting task. I wanted to call it What Happens When We Go. I didn't want to use the word die. I almost refused to. And a lot of parents and a lot of childhood education specialists said, you can't call it What Happens When We Go, because that will confuse people. People are be like, where are you going? Going to the supermarket? You know, where are you going? And people told me, like, use the word die and just own it and just do it. And I'm so glad I did, because this is everyone's favorite book of mine. Which I'm proud of, because it's my most recent one. So after four books, you know, I'm still, you know, it's not like I'm just trying to manufacture follow-ups from it. So I was really proud of the reception. And I just want to say I was inspired to write this from two short clips that I saw, you know, just surfing the net. One is, I don't know how long ago was ago, but Neil deGrasse Tyson went on the Larry David Show. And he spoke about death for 3 minutes. And he, you know, he just explains how he's not afraid of death, because were we afraid of the moments before we were born? No, because we weren't there. I mean, that's what death is like. And he explains how he's more afraid of living a life that doesn't mean much, or not creating meaning in our life. It was that, furthered by a clip that's still circling the net. It's on YouTube. Stephen Fry narrating an animated 2-minute video about death for the British Humanist Association, I think. And he says much of the same thing. And he explains how without death, you know, we would just get bored. It would be like eating a piece of cake that went on forever, or reading a story that went on forever. It just... death gives shape to our life, and mortality gives our life shape and makes us realize we have to enjoy every moment and spend it with the people we love and do the things we love and create the most amount of meaning and happiness that we can. And I'm like, this is perfect. Boom. So I did it. I did the kids' book, and that's what the book is about.
I'm so glad you mentioned that Stephen Fry piece, because this is something that, you know, I truly believe with every fiber of my being. It's something that I often argue with my co-hosts on the Skeptics Guide about, because many of them are futurists. They're a bit caught up in an immortalist movement. And I think that they truly believe that if they could live a very, very, very long life, I'm not sure if they'd, you know, and I say they, I'm speaking kind of with a broad brush. Each individual co-host has their own take on this. But we've often kind of butted heads about the idea of maybe not living forever, but living for like an incredibly extended period of time. And that's not something I would ever want, because I do worry, just like you said, the extended piece of cake. It's such a great analogy that without, for example, loss, we don't realize what we have. Without, you know, pain or rejection, it's very hard for us to understand what it feels to truly be in love. Without, you know, any sort of negative emotion, depression, for example, if we've never felt depressed, it's very hard for us to understand the depths of joy, because you need boundary experiences and you need, like you said, edges. You need structure, right, in an effort to understand what's existing within that structure. Otherwise, everything kind of homogenizes, doesn't
exactly
it?
Exactly. Yes. And you know, one thing I do in all my books is people that pre-order my books, they could put a lot of them, if they choose to, could put their faces in the book. Like they send me a picture of their face or their children's face or someone they love. And this book became far more emotional than I ever would have anticipated. There are pictures. I'm looking right now. There's a woman here who passed away about a week before this book came out. And her son read this children's book at her memorial and sent me the video. And I was sort of in tears that day. And
I can imagine.
There's a family in here with a parent who passed. And they said that this is the only place where all of their, you know, that right, you know, in that moment, they said this is the only place where all of their pictures are together in one place or something. Like, I mean, this book has been quite a journey for me, more than I anticipated.
Well, and it's also just such an important resource for individuals who are quite overwhelmed with the concept of talking about these things. I mean, you talked about the Stephen Fry commentary, which was so important. But even at the very beginning, I was struck when you mentioned that you originally didn't want to use the die in the title. And I'm, again, so glad you did, because avoiding it in you know, many ways is another perpetuation of something that I think is a wrong that needs to be righted in our society, which is the just utter denial, the utter refusal to admit that death even happens. We often don't want to talk about it. We don't want to think about it. We don't prepare for it. It always catches us off guard. It's an incredibly stressful and overwhelming time for many people when somebody dies, because they just simply haven't let themselves think about it. Something that in, you know, an aspect of existential psychology called terror management theory, something we call mortality salience, you know, how salient is your mortality to you? How often do you think about it? How often do you weigh, you know, the fact that you're going to die against the decisions that you make in your life? And there's, you know, a lot of very smart people who think that in improving our mortality salience really does have very positive psychological outcomes. And so this is a chance for you to do that with your children when they're young. And one thing I learned when I was reading a really great book by Yalom, a preeminent existential psychologist, is that kids know about death, even if you don't think they do. And they actually have sophisticated ideas about death. And if you never talk to them and you never engage with them about that, they could be harboring, you know, very intense fears. They could be harboring some very overt misconceptions. And even though generally speaking, they think about this and they know a lot more than we expect, if we don't ever talk to our kids about this, we don't know where their thoughts are going.
Absolutely. There's a lot of, it's important to, you know, kind of step in and not tell children what to think, but sort of be there for them and start conversations. Otherwise, you know, without guidance, I mean, you know, it's good to be there and kind of nudge them in the right direction, or at least show them things they might not have thought of, or tell them, you know, again, how we're connected to our world, and exactly help guide them a little bit.
Yeah, you know, we talked about this somewhat recently on the SGU, and I remember Jay was mentioning that his littles were asking about death, that it was becoming, you know, a relevant topic. And he was, you know, trying to navigate what to tell them, what not to tell them, how deep to get into it. And Steve, you know, told him that when his kids were young, because now they're in high school and college, you know, one of his approaches, and I think it's an approach that obviously I use in psychotherapy, is to just ask, you know, when you don't know where a kid's head is at, is to say, well, what do you think happens? Well, where do you think people go? Or what do you think is, you know, the outcome of that? Because it's always really informative how rich and how sophisticated their narrative really is. Whether or not it's reflective of reality, it's really interesting that they have a fully functional, generally speaking, idea in their head. Or they're working their way through it as they're speaking to you. And it's such a great opportunity to be able to to have that dialogue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I wish I could be on a fly on the wall when people are reading this to their kids to see just what kind of questions and crazy ideas kids come up with. So,
Yeah. Oh my gosh, me too. It would be so fascinating. Be an interesting psychological study, I must say. Well, JR, you know, we talked earlier a little bit about the fact that you live in a community where there's maybe some pushback against a more skeptical worldview. You sort of, you dipped your toe in a conversation when I first asked about what inspired you to write these books, about your own upbringing, about, you know, the role of religion, the role of science, the role of skepticism in your life. So I was wondering if maybe before we end the conversation, we can circle back to that. And maybe you can tell us a little bit more about, you know, the path that really led you here.
Sure. I could give kind of my origin story. It's not as exciting as Spider-Man or Batman, but we'll see what we could do. I grew up as in an Orthodox Jewish home. And I mean, I had a foot in the secular world. It wasn't like I was completely isolated, but we were taught, depending on the school year and the rabbi, but we were basically taught, whether it was explicit or implied, the world is 6,000 years old. And God created everything in 7 days. And, you know, if you would stay after school and kind of question it, you would kind of get, depending on who you spoke to, you would get sort of a mix of apologism and some science, you know, and some acceptance of science, sort of a mixture of those two. But I sort of, you know, I went with it. I figured everyone had doubts and that's that. And then about, I don't know, maybe it was eight or nine years ago, I heard a talk by a rabbi and he gave rational proofs for Judaism. And I loved his talk so much, not so much for what he said, but the fact that it reminded me that this conversation even existed. And I spoke with him after his talk and he told me he debates atheists. And thus I went down about a 3 to 4 year rabbit hole of me watching every single debate on YouTube I could get my hands on, hundreds of hours of debate between Hitchens and Krauss and Harris and Dawkins and Rabbi Wolpe and Rabbi Sacks and imams and priests and Dinesh D'Souza. And I mean, I went down that entire rabbit hole. I read all of their books. I learned every argument and every refutation of every refutation of every argument. It probably wasn't good for my health or my social life, but I'm just an analytical person who need, you know, once I'm on the hook, I need to get to the bottom of it. And I did. Now I know everything. there became a point where I said, you know, this is what we could know and this is what we can't know. And I feel like I had quite an idea of it. To me, it's all about who has the burden of proof and whether or not they meet that burden of proof. That's really about it. And I spent years listening to Matt Dillahunty's podcast and lots of programming like that to refine my thoughts. Tim Minchin was a big influence on me. He's like my God. I love that man.
He's great. And he's
so like
funny.
In another life, I can't say I'm him, but I want to be. I love him. I mean, so that's it. And then we kind of end up where I said before, I was kind of left with a vast emptiness. Like, so how does it all work? And where do morals come from? And where does meaning come from? As if it comes from somewhere, like we have to find it. And, you know, just all of these things. And I started, you know, what do I believe in? And how do things work? And, you know, instead of being, you know, the word atheist means lack of belief. So, you know, it's hard to live life knowing, you know, great. So I know what I lack, but what do I have and what can I create? And then you turn to the positive people like whoever, Bill Nye and Carl Sagan and many, many other names we could throw around. Bill Bryson's books are incredible. They were a big, you know, and you know, and lately evolutionary psychology sort of blows my mind. I mean, I went down the rabbit hole of hard determinism and genetic determinism and, you know, whether or not free will exists and all of that. And it's just, it's fascinating stuff. And it's just amazing. So that's basically my story.
JR, I gotta say, I'm right there with you, my friend. Like, the same things that fascinate you really do fascinate me. And I've just had such an incredible time talking to you about, you know, how all of these inputs, all of these experiences within your life really led you to what you do and where you are right now, and the incredible gift that you are giving back by producing these really whimsical, really beautiful, and actually quite, you know, brilliant pieces of children's literature. So I really do recommend that everybody who's listening, who has a kid in your life, you may not be a parent, I'm not, but you might have nieces, you might have nephews, you may have a local library that you can donate these books to. You know, there's a lot of ways that you can give back to a child who you think could really benefit from these stories. So I highly recommend that you go online and you purchase your copies of the Annabelle and Aiden series. There are 4 books, like we mentioned. JR, before we go, can you stick around just a few more minutes so that I can ask you my closing 2 questions?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, you mentioned before that you were listening to an episode, I think, with Anna Rothschild. So you probably know what's coming. Here we go. When you think about the future, I want you to tell me first, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night? The thing that you are maybe a bit pessimistic about, but on the flip side of that, what do you have, you know, true, genuine, real optimism for?
Yeah, so I was trying to think about this, and you know, lately I think I'm less positive and a little more pessimistic, unfortunately. But the positivity I'll get to in a minute, so hopefully it'll win the day. But yeah, just I think what keeps me up at night is false certainty. People just feel like they know all they need to know from their one book or their 10 books or their political bubble or their, you know, their social media bubble. I wish the world had more humility and more willingness to learn that maybe you're wrong. Tim Minchin says, you know, people are like asshole, or what is it? What do people and opinions have in common? What do people and assholes have in common? Everybody has one, and they should both be thoroughly examined every now and then. So, you know, take your opinions out and beat them with a stick. And I wish the world did more of that. And what I'm positive about is, you know, I see the false certainty in the world, and I'm on the front battle lines a lot, so it could bring me down. But then, you know, like a week ago, I did an event at an ethical culture society, and every time I meet my readers, whether it's in an ethical culture society, a humanist association, whatever it is, or even just in a bookstore, I'm inspired by the parents and the kids that come, and I see what kind of people they are and the amazing questions that my readers ask and the amazing messages I get about little kids learning about evolution or how learning about the first law of thermodynamics means that when they die, they'll, in a sense, never, their energy will live on forever. Little things like that, what turns people on, really, it inspires the hell out of me. So sometimes I'll get down and negative reading the negative news about our politicians or our, you know, the woo that surrounds us. But then when I read or meet the people that, you know, that are seeking out knowledge from books like mine or other people's books or podcasts like this one, I get really, really, really inspired by the questions they ask.
Well, what a great, great note to end the episode on. JR, it's been so much fun chatting with you. Will you let everybody out there know where they can find you on the internet?
Absolutely. So the best place to start is our website. It's annabelleandaiden.com, spelled in the most common way. So that's A-N-N-A-B-E-L-L-E and Aiden, AIDEN.com. And as this, depending on when you're listening to this podcast, there, it's very likely that we're running a Kickstarter right now or around now. Mm-hmm. So if people want to pre-order our fifth book, which, by the way, is about the story of the human species, they could find us on Kickstarter if they search Annabelle and Aiden.
Awesome. And what about social media? Are you active there?
Yes. So we are most active on our Facebook page. If people go to facebook.com/Annabelle and Aiden. And I'm embarrassed. I'm not even sure what our Instagram is, but you know, if people look for Annabelle and Aiden, I think it's Annabelle and then the letter N and then Aiden, because they wouldn't let us do the whole thing. It was too many characters. So Annabelle N Aiden. We're on Instagram and we're also on Twitter, but we're most active on Facebook.
Good to know. All right. Well, J.R. Becker, this was such a great chat. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.